Russia pressing for control over Ukraine's southeastern Donbas region after taking full control of the port city of Mariupol. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison concedes defeat in national elections that end a decade of conservative rule. And Palestinian mourners take part in the funeral of a 17-year-old boy who was shot dead by Israeli forces earlier today. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russia has just cut off flow of natural gas to Finland after it refused to pay for future supplies in the Russian national currency. Finland's energy firm says, although regrettable, the halt will cause no disruptions in the gas transmission network. Gazprom says that it has been carefully preparing for the situation. Last Saturday, Russia also cut electricity deliveries to Finland over payment issues. The developments come as Finland and Sweden are planning to join NATO. The two submitted their bids on Wednesday. Russia is opposed to their move, citing security threats caused by NATO expansion. Moscow has promised retaliation should Finland and Sweden join the Western military alliance. As the war in Ukraine continues, the West is taking measures spearheaded by the United States that would add more fuel to the burning flames. That is particularly concerning given the devastating toll the conflict is taking on the global economy. This begs the question, are we looking at a prolonged war in Europe, and if so, what would it mean for the rest of the world?
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February.
Russia had demanded security guarantees from the West before the war began on February 24. Had the U.S. and Europe granted that, the conflict could have been totally averted. But instead, the West responded with more pressure on Kremlin. And now it has practically turned Ukraine into a battleground for a proxy war with Russia. How can the situation therefore be diffused, if at all?
As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but they're inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
As a correspondent, Johnny Miller reports from Mariupol, which is now under Russian control, Russian forces are moving out of the town and heading for the heart of the conflict zone in Luhansk, Donbass region.
I'm currently just outside Mariupol, where the last of the Ukrainian soldiers in the Azov battalion are finally surrendering. It's a great victory for the Russians to take Mariupol, but the Ukrainians are also saying that it's a victory for them. Why? Because those fighters at Azovstal were able to hold off or take up time in the Russian army. The Russian army had to surround that steel plant for a long time, stopping Russian soldiers moving elsewhere in the war. And in part, that's correct. When we were coming up this road this morning from Donetsk, we had to wait by the side of a country road for about half an hour as an entire Russian battle group moved past us. Dozens of tanks, dozens of supply trucks, all leaving Mariupol now and heading to where the fighting is in Donbass and Luhansk. Right now, there, the Russian army is trying to encircle the bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're having success using artillery. Even Zelensky, who normally downplays Russian successes, has said today that it is, in his words, hell in Donbass as the Russians use artillery. Many of the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches are dying without even being able to see the Russian army. This road here, we're heading back to Donetsk now. There's a straight road and there's a safe road because on the straight road, there is only about 4 kilometers away at one part is a village held by the Ukrainian army, and they often shell cars coming along. A reminder, the Ukrainians still hold huge parts of Donbass. But the Battle of Mariupol is over. The battle for Donbass and Luhansk is going to accelerate in the next few days.
U.S. President Joe Biden visits South Korea and Japan this week to strengthen alliances and to send a message to China. In Seoul for a summit with new conservative South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, Biden emphasized the U.S. alliance commitment to the defense of South Korea. Still, some worry about North Korea's response to the hard line being charted by the U.S. and its regional partners. Frank Smith has more from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks. while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily, will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his five-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Australia's Conservative Prime Minister has conceded defeat in national elections as vote counting gets underway.
It's a difficult night for Liberals and Nationals around the country, as nights like this always are. They are humbling, but so is victory. Victory is also humbling and always should be. Tonight, I've spoken to the Leader of the Opposition and the incoming Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and I've congratulated him on his election victory this evening.
Scott Morrison says even though vote counting is incomplete, the opposition Labour Party looks likely to form a government. He added that he would stand down as the leader of the Liberal National Coalition Party. Early results show the Labour Party has 72 seats and needs 76 seats of the 151-seat House to form a government. The defeat ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in the government. Inflation and climate change were major voter concerns during this election. Australia's inflation has surged to its highest in over two decades. That is higher than the current wage growth, leaving many people concerned about rising living costs. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old killed by Israeli forces. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayed, was shot dead during a raid on Jenin refugee camp. Another Palestinian teenager was also critically wounded. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh condemned Fayed's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident came days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhla while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. A correspondent, Mona Kandil, says Israeli forces keep attacking the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, retaliation for Palestinians' anti-Israeli operations.
Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin refugee camp and the city because we have to remind our viewers that a number of Palestinians from Jenin carried out anti-Israel operations and left Israeli settlers dead and wounded in the last few months. And this, of course, had angered the Israeli military and the Israeli street as well. So in order to silence the Israeli settlers, and the demands by the Israelis to change the Israeli cabinet, the Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin and its refugee camp almost on a daily basis, storming Palestinians' homes, arresting people, shooting at Palestinians and Palestinian youths.
Syria says its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles during a fresh attack near the capital, Damascus. Syria's defense ministry says the strikes left three people dead and led to some material damage. Earlier, Syrian media reported that air defenses confronted hostile targets in the sky in the Damascus countryside. The reports said the Israeli attack also caused a fire near Damascus International Airport, delaying a number of flights. Israel earlier launched a volley of missiles on Syria on May 14th, killing five Syrian soldiers. On Damascus, a correspondent, Muhammad Ali, tells us more about the repeated acts of Israeli aggression against Syria.
According to an official military source, at about 11 p.m. local time in Damascus, Israel carried out a missile attack, a surface-to-surface missile attack, which was launched from the occupied Syrian Golan and hit targets in areas in the southern countryside of Damascus. Right away, Syria's air defenses, as usual, intercepted the attack, shooting down most of the enemy missiles. However, it seems that some of them did hit their targets, because three persons were killed as a result of this attack. Now, definitely, this is not the first kind of attack, especially this year, or at least this month, in which Israel stepped up its attacks, whether in central Syria, in areas like Musyaf and Hama, or around the Syrian capital, Damascus, or in the south, around Al-Quneitra. Syria always sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General with regards to such attacks. But so far, despite the tens of letters, there are still international silence about this. Still, there is no action being taken as an independent country is being attacked, a sovereign country is being attacked.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Michael German, a former FBI special agent who infiltrated white supremacist groups in the 1990s, says the FBI continues to underplay the scope of the threat. We're prepared for you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled, Former Special Agent Warns FBI Failing to Address White Supremacist Violence. A leading authority on law enforcement has told The Guardian that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is failing to address the rising scourge of white supremacist violence, despite stark warnings that such attacks pose the greatest domestic terrorism threat in the United States. Michael German, a former FBI special agent who infiltrated white supremacist groups in the 1990s, said the Bureau continues to underplay the scope of the threat. As a result, communities targeted by white supremacists and far-right militia groups, such as the largely African-American neighborhoods in Buffalo, New York, where 10 people were killed by a racist gunman recently, are left fatally exposed. Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center at New York University School of Law, says U.S. law enforcement is failing, as it long has, to provide victimized communities like Buffalo's with equal protection under the law. They're not actually investigating the crimes that occur. Recent mass shooting incidents in Buffalo was carried out by a white gunman who selected the top supermarket because it served one of the largest black populations in the state. In a 180-page diatribe he is believed to have posted online, he espoused the false racist belief that white Americans are being replaced by immigrants of color. Numerous recent studies have pinpointed white supremacy as the greatest domestic terrorism threat in America today. The FBI itself has sounded the alarm bells, with its former director Christopher Wray telling Congress in 2020 that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists were the main source of ideological killings, superseding Takfiri terrorists. In an interview with The Guardian, Michael German said that U.S. law enforcement in general and the FBI in particular were lagging behind. Despite a clear mandate from Congress, the Bureau has yet to produce statistics revealing the scale of white supremacist crimes, adding, "White supremacists kill far more Americans than anybody else the FBI designates as domestic terrorists, yet the Bureau still doesn't document the crimes and fatalities that occur." Michael German added, "I think that's a reflection of lack of concern for the victims of that violence." U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland put out a statement after the Buffalo mass shooting in which he pledged to seek justice for the innocent victims. He said, "The Justice Department would treat the massacre as a hate crime and an act of racially motivated violent extremism." In Michael German's opinion, both these designations, hate crime and racially motivated violent extremism, are problematic in terms of how they are routinely applied to white supremacist incidents. Most acts that are deemed to be hate crimes are deferred by the Department of Justice to state and local police for investigation, though 85% of those agencies do not recognize hate crimes as a phenomenon. Michael German said police in these jurisdictions don't record or may not even investigate hate crimes, so the incident gets lost. The invisibility of white supremacist hatred to law enforcement is reflected in those official figures that do exist. In recent years, surveys based on the experiences of crime victims themselves have recorded more than 200,000 hate crime incidents each year. Now compare that with the average number of hate crime cases prosecuted by the Department of Justice annually. 21, Michael German said. Racially motivated violent extremism is also less than helpful as a designation, though it is classed as terrorism. It is a catch-all in which white supremacy groups are lumped together with black nationalists and those classified as black identity extremists. The end result is that the spotlight that should tightly focus on the growing threat of white supremacy is diffused. Federal resources are scattered between animal rights groups, Native American protesters, and even non-violent civil disobedience movements designated as terrorist entities, though there is no evidence that such groups exist. Meanwhile, organized criminal groups dedicated to upholding white power fly largely beneath the radar. Michael German said there is a dramatic contrast with the overweening surveillance that was aimed at Muslim communities after the 9/11 events. He pointed to the many telltale signs that the Buffalo suspect appears to have offered months before Saturday's 14th of May's attack. He announced a murder-suicide mission at his school that was referred to state police. According to the Washington Post, the matter was dropped after the individual reassured them he had been joking. Michael German said, "Can you imagine if the Buffalo shooter had been a Muslim?" And he was telling his friends that he was enamored with Osama bin Laden, adding, "You have to think the response would have been very different." Michael German said it was puzzling that an institution like the FBI, that had effectively turned itself into a counterterrorism intelligence agency after 9/11, was, by contrast, so lax in its handling of white supremacy. He said one factor was that the FBI displays the prejudices of American society writ large, adding, "We fail to recognize how foundational white supremacism is to our culture." FBI agents are also overwhelmingly white and male, and the Bureau has been infused with elements of white supremacist ideology stretching back decades. Michael German knows that from personal experience. He said, "When I was going undercover in the 1990s, I was warned about sympathy towards white supremacy among officers. That was raised as a hazard for my undercover FBI operation." In 2006, the FBI drew up an internal intelligence assessment that found that white supremacist presence among law enforcement personnel is a concern. It said that organized groups were infiltrating law enforcement agencies, while individuals sympathetic to white supremacist causes were also joining the ranks. That was 16 years ago. To this day, there has been no national effort to root out the infection. Michael German says if there had been an internal FBI report that Takfiris had infiltrated U.S. law enforcement, you'd expect a nationwide attempt to get to the bottom of it. Given the devastating nature of the Buffalo shooting incident and President Biden's promise to the victims' families that hate will not prevail, the Department of Justice is likely to devote resources to this particular investigation. But Michael German warns that the underlying tendency to under-record and underestimate the scope of white supremacist criminal activity shows no sign of changing. What does that do to people of color who are the targets of all the hatred? It creates a recognition for these communities that they have to solve their own problems. They know that law enforcement, the FBI included, treat them harshly when they are suspects and ignore them when they are victims.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Allah, Allah.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are trying to look at human rights and the right of a person to live and have a prosperous, happy life from an Islamic perspective. When it comes to the human life itself, it goes through number of stages. It goes through the embryo stage and then goes to becoming a child in the mother's womb and then to giving birth to him and then childhood and adulthood and so on and so forth. Islam, when he looks at human rights, he gives it a comprehensive look from day one when the child is consumed in the stomach of the mother. Even as an embryo, Islam has forbidden what we call today abortion, that a child should be miscarried deliberately by the mother or a choice of both parents. So when Islam goes to such depth, you can see how comprehensive it is in this regard, that even abortion is considered to be forbidden. Now, you look at countries, and I constantly repeat this, who are at least what they acclaim to be the preservers of human rights, and they have the Human Rights Charter and the human rights this and the human right that, and the United Nations, who apparently seems to speak for humanity and its rights, they give people the right to take another life. And that is obviously to allow abortion. In a lot of countries, and if not majority of the countries, abortion is allowed. Women can kill their own babies. That is a crime against humanity. I mean, if you did not want the child, obviously you should have used measures to prevent it from happening in the first place. But now the child is here, he's in the stomach, he's in the womb, you have no right to take it away. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given it life, and it is now out of your hand. So if you look at the numbers, if you look at the statistics of how many people and how many, especially females, who go through the process of abortion, the numbers are staggering. It's a scary rate where women end up having an abortion. Now, that itself, obviously, killing and taking a life of another human being, which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has stood firmly against from day one. So, for example, if you look at it from an Islamic perspective, that notion is forbidden, that abortion is forbidden. No parent, be it male or female, have the right to take the baby's life. It's done, end of story. And if they decide to get an abortion for a reason or two, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, obviously, I mean, you know, fiqh-wise, if we're talking about jurisprudence, there are exceptions to the formula, especially if the life of the mother is in danger or this and that. But I'm not talking about the exceptions. I'm talking about in general cases. If that happens, then they have to pay what we call diya, compensation for taking that life. So as we see that Islam is very comprehensive in trying to ensure that the rights of man is preserved from the moment he is born. Now, let us take a short break and then we will continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Now, as we have been saying, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through the Quran, or through the words of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa ala, or through the words of the Imams alayhim as-salam, they have emphasized and they have stretched that point way too far and way too long when it came to preserving the rights of mankind, especially when it comes to the rights of living and having a prosperous life. We gave so many examples from the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, and how he himself was a champion of that. When he spent all his life trying to prevent bloodshed, be it in the Muslim world or be it outside that, when there were other, you know, chances for war to happen. Now, even to just fair to highlight, even our other imams, alayhim assalam, they have intervened in many times, in many occasions, to prevent wars from happening and bloodshed happening within the Muslims or within other, be it the surrounding countries or the nations surrounding to Islam, be it the Persians or be it the Romans or what have you. So we can see that the Ahl Bayt alayhim salam, they moved on that scale where they have tried to preserve right of people and the right for people to live. And more importantly, as we have been saying, that ensuring the life of a person is one thing, ensuring the life of his spirituality is another thing, but also ensuring him to have the right to live in a dignified manner, to live in a free manner. Because sometimes when we live under systems where I have no freedom to speak, I have no freedom to practice my faith, I have no freedom to move around, then I am no longer a human being. I'm just a slave or a servant to the system that I'm under. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, in his famous speech or his famous quote that he said on the Battle of Karbala, he said when he's talking to the soldiers of Umar ibn Sa'd, he says, if you do not believe in the hereafter, at least be free. In the sense that, you know, live the values of life. Don't be servant to your own desires and to your own pleasures. You know, live that life where you feel that you are dignified, that you are a free human being, you are no longer bound, or you are stuck to the bondage and the chains of someone else. Live that free life. So the Ahl Bayt alayhim salam and the Quran and all the things that we have been saying throughout, I don't know, over God knows how many episodes, when we have been talking about the right of human beings and human rights, is that a human needs, he has a right to live and live a prosperous, happy and dignified life. Inshallah, we'll leave it up to here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
In Britain, police chiefs will declare they're ashamed about racism remaining in law enforcement and apologise for the discrimination and bias still plaguing police forces in a new race plan which will launch next week. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Vikram Dodd. The piece is titled Police Chiefs to Apologise for Racism, Discrimination and Bias in Race Plan. Britain police chiefs will declare they're ashamed about racism remaining in law enforcement and apologise for the discrimination and bias still plaguing police forces in a new race plan which will launch next week. The plan from National Police Chiefs Council and College of Policing will avoid admitting institutional racism, which critics brand a failure which could doom the promised reforms. However, it will instead commit to being institutionally anti-racist and aim to start winning back the confidence of black people, which among black Caribbean people is 20% lower than the national average. They vow to end the treatment which black people find stigmatizing and humiliating, and police chiefs from England and Wales will say, "We accept that policing still contains racism, discrimination and bias. We're ashamed of those truths. We apologise for them and we are determined to change them." The plan, running to more than 50 pages, follows months of intense and at times bitter discussions. It was triggered by the mass protests after the murder of George Floyd in the United States by a police officer, and has taken so long it will be published just a day before the second anniversary of George Floyd's death. The document and planned reforms comes after decades of promises by policing to stamp out racism in the ranks and failure to deliver. In 1999, policing was declared to be institutionally racist by the McPherson Inquiry into the police blunders that allowed the racist murderers of Stephen Lawrence to escape justice after he was stabbed to death at a London bus stop. Policing has in large part, especially in the Met, declared that the label no longer applies. The Guardian has revealed chiefs were debating a public declaration almost a quarter of a century on from the McPherson Inquiry that policing remained so. Some chief constables and community experts that consulted insisted that accepting the label was the essential starting point to repair the damage. Otherwise, any plan risked never even getting a hearing from the communities weary of promises and false claims they had been delivered. Police leaders could not agree to accept forces were still institutionally racist, even holding a vote. The police chiefs will say much has been done in the intervening years by policing to address racism in the police and society. Despite this, change has not been fast nor significant enough in black communities. As we have prepared this plan, we have heard the views of black people on their experiences of policing. We have listened to the voices of our own black colleagues about the service that they belong to. The challenge for reform set out by the McPherson Inquiry cannot be said to have been unambiguously answered by policing. Many people believe policing is still institutionally racist and have grounds for this view. The murder of George Floyd in the United States saw over 250,000 people take to streets in Britain in support of Black Lives Matter movement and calls for racial justice in a phalanx of protests despite the country being in lockdown. Discussions within policing and ethnic minority officers saw some police chiefs realize the race problems in their forces were more severe than they had realized. The document says, "We have much to do to secure the confidence of black people, including our own staff, and improve their experience of policing. And we will. We will be held to account and we welcome scrutiny." That need for change is evident. Policing lags behind almost every part of the public service as an employer of colour for black people. Confidence levels are much lower and our power are disproportionately applied to black people. In some crimes, victimisation rates are higher. Black police officers and staff leave policing earlier in their careers than white staff. And the fact we have only seen two black officers reach chief constable or assistant commissioner rank in policing history is a failure in itself. One police chief constable who supports accepting policing is institutionally racist said, "All the figures show it still is." One chief who opposed it said the label was unhelpful and not accurate. Victor Olissa, former head of diversity at Scotland Yard, said failing to admit institutional racism will blow the credibility of the new promises. They may say that they will do better, but without an admission of the institutional racism, it wouldn't be believed in communities. Police chiefs are being insular and doing what suits them and not the service of the public. The police chiefs will say that the argument that policing reflects biases in society is not good enough. Policing has a much higher obligation than any other public service, given its ability to deprive liberty and use the most intrusive powers. The collective trust of society is critical to a police service built upon consent. Sources involved in discussion said while high on aspiration, the plan risked lacking specifics. Police chiefs will adopt a policy to explain or reform on racial disparities, such as stop and search, and the plan will say black people are 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white people, and 5 times more likely to be subjected to the use of force. Testimonies tell us that black people find these encounters, particularly stop and search, confrontational, stigmatizing, and humiliating. 10% of our recorded searches, 27% of use of force incidents, and 35% of taser incidents involved someone from the black ethnic group. The latest estimate suggests that only 3.5% of the population is black. Police chiefs have brought in independent scrutiny, and the public will be encouraged to give their views on that plan. The plan is produced by the NPCC and the College of Policing and will now be consulted upon and may change. They state their aim is, "Our vision is for a police service that is anti-racist and trusted by black people."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today we're going to be looking at a very interesting hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Al-Qazim alayhi salam, Imam Musa bin Ja'far alayhi salam, regarding the reward for getting a fellow Muslim married, right, helping out in the marriage of another Muslim. So if you have your brother, he wants to get married, or your sister in Islam, she wants to get married, and she's having a hard time doing so, if you can help them out, you're going to reap a lot of reward. As attested to in this very beautiful hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Qazim alayhi salam. The Imam says, there are three types of people who will be shaded by Allah's throne on the day when no shade will avail apart from it. As you know, the day of resurrection is a day when the sun will shine very directly over the heads of people. It's a very hot day. People will be very thirsty because of the heat of that day. And the only people who will find shade on that day are those who are close to God, close to His throne, and who enjoy the shade which the throne, the arsh of Allah, you know, casts upon the earth. There's a kind of indication and allusion to their being in the proximity of God. Who are these people? Who are these three types of people? The Imam says, the one who arranged the marriage of a fellow Muslim brother. The one who arranged the marriage of a fellow Muslim brother. If you help in the arrangement of a fellow Muslim brother, it doesn't mean you should go and, you know, take it upon yourself to get this person married from beginning to end, pay all his expenses, find him the wife. Nah, it could be just like, you know, you're giving this, helping this person out, you know, in some way or another. This could even be counted, you know, as you're helping him out in his marriage. So this is the first group. The second group, or served him in some way. The second one is kind of a part of the first one, or you might say it includes the first one as well. Serving your brother in some way. Let's say that your brother is sick, he needs your help. You know, you make him some, you know, dinner and you bring it to him. Or, you know, let's say that your neighbor, your fellow Muslim brother who's your neighbor, right? You know, his child needs, you know, he needs to be taught something. He's having trouble in school. Oh, you go help him out, help your neighbor's child out. You know, teach him what, you know, he needs to learn. Help him out in this way. It could be a lot of things. All of these are cases and instances of serving your brother in faith. If you do that, you'll be included in this group of people who are shaded by the throne of God. Finally, the Imam says, or concealed his Muslim brother's faults from others. This is also something very big. You know, you know your brother has a lot of faults, has a lot of, you know, mistakes. He commits a lot of mistakes. He has a lot of sins. Not disclosing those sins or those faults in front of others is also, you know, a good deed, and you'll be rewarded for it in the hereafter, you know, by being allowed to take refuge in the shade of the throne of God. Of course, this is not, we're not talking about those faults and mistakes which could harm others, you know, and you know, be a harm to others or even the person himself. In this case, obviously, this person should kind of take it upon himself to tell others and to prevent this person from harming the other people or himself. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the reward for getting a fellow Muslim married in the words of Imam Al-Qadhim alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
The spotlight.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. In this edition, the BRICS countries have backed a Chinese suggestion that the bloc should be expanded. A joint statement by the foreign ministers of the bloc, which also includes Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, following